funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's one of the great ironies of parenting. Our job is to ensure that our children can someday get by without us. From helping infants learn to fall asleep on their own, to showing school-age kids how to safely use the stove and cross the street, to that white-knuckle day when we hand over the keys to the car and say, "You drive," each progressive lesson represents another step toward their independence. Except when it doesn't. As Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford, Julie Lithcott-Hames noticed some rather disturbing changes over the decades of her career there. Parents would arrive every fall to drop their kids off and then have a hard time leaving. They'd return at a moment's notice to lobby their kids' professors or intervene in roommate squabbles. They even wanted to sit in on job interviews. Surely this was all done out of love, but it didn't seem to be doing these young adults any favors. Julie Lithcott-Hames has written a new book identifying the problem and offering remedies. It's called How to Raise an Adult: Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Julie, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks so much for having me.
It would seem that most parents, and I'll put myself in this category, are really good at pointing at other people who are doing the overparenting. Why is it so hard to recognize the mistakes we might be making ourselves?
Well, Chris, let me say right off the bat, I'm a parent myself, and it was only when I realized my own complicitness in this problem that I really began to be able to focus on what to do about it. You know, we all, as you've said so beautifully, we're doing everything we do for our kids out of fierce love and a desire for them to be wildly successful and happy. It's just that we've gotten misguided lately about, you know, what preparation for adulthood actually means. I'll tell you, my own aha moment came one day in 2009. Every year when Stanford parents brought their new freshmen to campus, we'd have a dinner for them and give some talks. And the purpose of the talks was to say, hey, folks, trust that your kid has what it takes. Trust the university's going to do right by them. And please go home. And we gave this message as we did every year. We gave it in 2009. And the next night I came home and sat down for dinner with my own two kids and husband. My kids were 8 and 10 at the time. And I leaned over and began cutting my 10-year-old's meat. And all of a sudden I realized, oh my gosh, I'm going to be one of those parents that can't let go at 18 because I'm cutting his meat and he's 10. And when do you stop cutting their meat? There's no manual that tells you this. When do you let them cross the street? When do you let them do their own homework? And when do you let them talk to strangers? So, you know, I think my book is not this sort of finger wagging criticism of parents. It's an arms embrace that says, look, folks, we are overparenting. What are we going to do about it?
So you and I are both Gen Xers, and everybody worried about the effect of this giant generation of latchkey kids. What actually worked about the way people born in the 60s and 70s were raised?
Well, you know, yeah, here we are, latchkey, sandwiched between the enormous millennials and their parents, the boomers. You know, like it or not, you know, let's define latchkey for a moment for those listeners who might be younger and not know the phrase. You know, we were kids whose moms had gone back to work and dads were still working. So we had to let ourselves in after school with a key, and we had to give ourselves a snack, and we had to do our own homework and monitor that for ourselves and go out to play when we felt like it and come home for dinner. You know, what I think we got from that was a tremendous sense of self, this sense that I'm competent, I'm capable, I'm trusted to do what I'm supposed to do this afternoon, to feed myself, you know, and do my homework. And, you know, I don't know that our parents intended that. I mean, that wasn't the reason they gave us those keys. It was really the necessity that, hey, kid, no one's home. You got to look after yourself. But the beautiful byproduct was we did for ourselves.
So how did we get from the way that we raised kids or people raised kids a generation or two ago to the way that we're raising them today?
Well, you know, it began with the baby boomers who themselves, there's this great irony. So baby boomers, when they themselves were in their late teens and 20s, seized the right to be heard. They were the first generation of young adults and teenagers to, you know, demand a voice for themselves. And in so doing, they managed to topple some major assumptions about our society and its paradigms and mores. You know, they lay themselves on the line for the civil rights movement and women's rights and the Vietnam War. And there are so many transformational things accomplished by the baby boom, who demanded that they ought to be able to question authority. Here's what happened when they became parents. They were still questioning authority at every turn on behalf of their own kids. They decided, you know what? We know best. We want to be heard. You know, we're going to kind of supplant ourselves in the role our kids might want to play, but we're going to be right there alongside them, doing it for them. And the great irony that I alluded to is they were so interested in their own self-actualization, they've now managed to deprive their own kids of being self-actualized by having done too much for them. So that's who did it. And of course, we, Gen X, we're just following along. We're parenting the way parents parent now. And I imagine the millennial generation is inclined to do the same unless we manage to really put a stop to this. But I'd also like to tell you when it started, because I think that's important too, Chris. In the early to mid 80s, there were four things that happened. And by the way, this is when boomers were parenting and the first set of millennials were being born. We began with stranger danger in the early 1980s, a couple of well-publicized horrific cases that created the sense in the nation's mindset and psyche that there's a stranger on every corner. The statistics simply don't bear it out. But we began to be that fearful as a nation and to feel that kids can't walk alone, can't bike alone, can't go to the park, can't go to school alone. That happened in the early to mid 80s. Then we had the self-esteem movement, also born around the same time, that said just applaud kids for showing up, certificates, trophies, ribbons for any little thing. And the only person that profited, or the only group that profited from that, is the ribbon and trophy and certificate industry. It doesn't help kids' self-esteem. The third thing is, the playdate was born in 1984. Parents began not only scheduling play, but hovering over play, intervening in play, telling kids what to play, and getting involved when kids had disputes. And then finally, A Nation at Risk, also published around this time, said American teenagers need to be tested more and taught to the test. So all of a sudden, in the early to mid-80s, we had parents involved in play and homework and, you know, escorting kids outside and applauding them for every single moment of their existence. And that's how this all began.
So I'm sure we'll talk about all of these things in greater depth, but it is interesting, you know, when you talk about the play date, that also extends to things like, you know, like if dad hears a kid banging away on a toy xylophone, he runs to the internet and finds somebody to give music theory classes. And if mom notices her little one turning cartwheels, she consults a gymnastics coach. At what point does enthusiasm for kids' interests turn into pressure?
Well, you know, it's a careful balance. I think if a parent, you know, hears their kid on the xylophone or sees their kid turning cartwheels, it's great to pay attention and say, hey, that's something my kid likes. How can I, with my means, whatever they may be, how can I support that interest? But we shouldn't zoom ahead and presume our kid will be the Andre Agassi of that, you know, that right. activity or sport. And in fact, Agassi's a great example. He had the skill. No doubt. You don't become number one in men's tennis without having the skill. But you know what he lacked? He lacked the interest. And so when you read his memoir, he was dragged down that path. He's miserable. He's unhappy, resentful. You know, boo-hoo, you might say. Poor Andre Agassi. He's got all these trophies and championships. But I kind of feel for the guy. He was forced down, you know, that path by a very overzealous dad. Jeremy Lin is a great counterexample. The improbably tall child of Taiwanese immigrants wants to play basketball. Okay, they say, as long as you still go to church, we'll find you some basketball to play. You know, he'll never be to basketball what Agassi is to tennis. But boy, is he happy with what he's done.
We've also worked hard to eliminate bullying from schools. And I think most people would agree that's a very good thing. But our definition of bullying and what our kids can't take and can't possibly stand has expanded, it seems, beyond like real terrorism on the playground to these really minor infractions.
Absolutely. I write about this in my book. I spoke with a wonderful educator out here in California named Olaf Jorgensen, who works at an independent school, is the head of school. And he had some parents come to him in his preschool and say, we want to talk to you about a serious incident of bullying. And he thought, my God, bullying in the preschool. And he set up, you know, he met with them right away and he had his pad of paper and pen out. And he began listening as the parents described how their 2 or 3 year old had been bonked on the head with a plastic shovel in the sandbox by another 2 or 3 year old. And he thought, oh my goodness, this is developmentally normal. This is a natural part of childhood. Of course, there was a moment of hurt and pain. He learned that the teacher had seen it happen, came over, you know, soothe the child who was crying, talk to the kid who had done it, you know, had the one who'd done it apologize to the one who'd been hit, and they went on their way. I mean, this is a classic example of what childhood will offer and must happen. You know, when a parent swoops in and makes sure that doesn't happen, they don't learn those lessons. And when a kid has been hit over the head with a plastic shovel in the sandbox at 3, and the parent rushes in to scream at somebody, that kid cowers in the corner and feels like a victim. Hmm. And that's the sort of insidious, unintended side effect of this overuse of the bullying label. You know, we want our kids to be strong and to be able to speak up for themselves, yeah, with guidance and advice from parents, but holy moly, they've got to make their way before long. We've got to know they've got the skills.
I don't know if you did this when your kids were little, but you know how like a toddler will fall down and the best thing to do is wait. If they start to cry, you scoop them up and give them a hug. And if they're okay, you just leave them alone. It seems like we're not waiting so much anymore.
We're not waiting. It's a beautiful example. And Chris, to be honest, I think I was probably doing too much scooping up then. So it wasn't just the cutting my kids' meat at 10. I was over helping when they were toddlers. Let me tell you something I learned in the course of researching how to raise an adult. There are these guys in Minnesota, Minneapolis, I believe, who are a pair of guys who've written a book called GIST. One's a pediatrician, one's a child psychologist, and they saw in their pediatric and psychology practices too many kids who'd been, you know, overparented, who'd had the path smoothed for them. And they put together this beautiful list of things we parents must let our kids experience, even if it makes us wince. And they gave me permission to reprint the list in my book. It's this point that, look, you know, we have to tolerate the ability to wince when our kid gets kind of a minor slight, a minor bruise, a bump, you know, rather than to pounce on them and protect or prevent them from it. You know, we can't hold them in our arms forever. You know, life will come with bumps and bruises. And what these guys who wrote GIST say is we have to nod our head and say, yep, that's exactly what needed to happen. They'll learn from that. And these are not just the bumps and scrapes, but kind of the emotional things like you didn't get invited to a party or you couldn't go to something with friends because it's grandma's birthday or, you know, you broke a vase in a store, you know, whatever it is. Hey, this happens. Let's not act like it's, you know, a terrible thing. Let's just acknowledge, yeah, this is life. Let's help teach them to learn to cope with it. Life goes on.
The irony of all that smoothing that we're trying to do to prevent them from really feeling any knocks along the way growing up is that there appears to be a real correlation between overparenting and depression and anxiety in young adulthood.
Yeah. You know, when I first began to write about this issue, it was 2005. I was 3 years into my role as freshman dean at Stanford. And let me just as an aside say, this is by no means just a Stanford problem. My colleagues at colleges and universities across the nation in every tier, you know, would talk about this when we went to our annual conferences. I happen to see it at Stanford. It is happening and was happening everywhere. So the irony of smoothing is yeah, they don't seem to have what it takes to cope. I'm sorry, I lost the train of your question.
Overparented kids have anxiety as young adults.
Right, right. Okay, so here's my point. Sorry about that. So when I first began writing about this 3 years into my role as dean, it was 2005, I wrote an op-ed based on my hunch that this couldn't be good for young adults. I was seeing them still scanning the sidelines for mom or dad, even though they were 18, 20, 22 years old. Mom or dad, what do I do? How do I do it? Can you advocate for me? And so on. My hunch was it wouldn't be good for them in the long run. Nowadays, thanks to great work in the field of psychology, study after study, really in the last 3 to 4 years, has come out showing much higher rates of anxiety and depression in kids who have been overparented. So, you know, on the one hand, I feel vindicated because I've been talking about this for 10 years. And on the other hand, it makes me incredibly sad. You know, we've got to pay attention to this fact. Our young people are suffering. It's our job to help them, not to hinder them on their path to adulthood.
Julie Lithcott-Hames is with us. She has been Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford and is author of the new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. We'll join the conversation in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join the conversation, rather, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Thank you. Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Julie Lithcott-Hames, Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford. And her new book is called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Julie, there's also the issue these days, and I'm sure you're well familiar with this, of the perception that the race to a decent college begins in preschool. How did we come to a place where it's literally too late, or at least the perception is that it's too late, for a kid to blossom, say, sophomore or junior year of high school?
Yeah, Chris, this is an enormous problem. When I went looking for the causes of overparenting, I found, you know, the fear of stranger danger and this college admissions arms race as two of the most dominant driving factors. I think, first and foremost, our definition of decent college, as you put it, is all wrong. We've gotten duped by U.S. News and World Report. This is a magazine that makes its money off of the annual college issue. It is, as Gwen Ifill has put it, the equivalent of Sports Illustrated's swimsuit issue, okay? It is the one, you know, annual issue on which the entire franchise rests financially. So let's just call it what it is. You know, I don't think you should choose a college the way anyone chooses a swimsuit or whatever it is one is doing when looking at that swimsuit issue. The point is, a fantastic education comes in places where faculty are devoted to teaching and mentoring undergraduates, okay? Some of the very best teaching in this country happens at community colleges and at small liberal arts colleges and, of course, at big state schools and, of course, at some of the very elite privates. The point is, if you're a big university, you might not be paying so much attention to undergraduate education or to undergraduate teaching. I mean, schools that are large and focused on research really have to make a concerted effort to focus on teaching undergraduates, and some of them do. But there's plenty of great teaching happening and, by, you know, correspondingly great learning happening and a great education obtained at schools, quote unquote, no one has heard of. So in my community, I'm all about talking about the schools no one has heard of, quote unquote, and getting parents to pull back their blinders and not be beholden to the top 20 list, according to U.S. News. Let's not choose a school like it's a brand name, like it's jeans or a Coca-Cola or Pepsi product. You know, it's a four-year education. It's about so much more than brand name. So that's step one.
I've spoken to a number of administrators at, you know, Ivy League schools, at schools like Stanford, which is like a West Coast Ivy, and at, you know, really excellent public universities. Most people seem to agree with you about the U.S. News and World Report thing, and yet the competition continues. Has there been any talk in your industry about somehow boycotting this, about not submitting whatever information is required, or simply saying we're not going to participate in this anymore?
You know, there are a few brave schools that have done that. Reed College, Sarah Lawrence College, they've both taken on these systems. But you know what? They get dinged for doing so. I believe it was Sarah Lawrence that said, we're not going to submit our SAT scores to you, U.S. News and World Report. And U.S. News said, fine, Sarah Lawrence, we're going to assume they're 200 points lower than your peers. In other words, they were punished for not participating. So, you know, yeah, a group of educators did try to come together about a decade ago, led by a guy named Lloyd Thacker, put together a book called College Unranked, with a bunch of great essays from college presidents and admissions deans, to really try to wrestle this admission arms race away from, you know, these moneyed interests and return it to a process that actually embraces the purpose of higher education in the first place, which is, you know, educate the whole human. So, yeah, efforts are underway. You know, my colleagues at Stanford, I know, are really concerned that childhood today seems to be mortgaged in furtherance of getting into a place like Stanford or its peers. You know, they didn't intend that. When I was admitted to Stanford in 1985, you know, what it took for me to distinguish myself was nothing compared to what it takes a kid today. But kids today are the same age I was when I applied, and there are still only 168 hours in a week. So why is it that we're asking kids to be, you know, superhuman, stellar, to have some singular noteworthy achievement accomplished by the time they sit down to write their essays? It's just gotten to be too much. I think really thoughtful people in the admissions profession are concerned about this. They love kids. You know, they're interested in giving kids opportunity, not in undermining their mental health. And I think actually that's been the key. As admissions people have sat down with mental health colleagues on their same, you know, on their own campus, they're beginning to connect the dots. And I know the folks in admissions do want to do something about this, and I think they will.
Okay.
In the meantime, though, let me add, in the meantime, we've got kids to raise, and we've, you know, people listening might have a rising junior or a senior in high school, and you're saying, but what do I do in the meantime? And in the meantime, I'll tell you what I say in my own house. We value mental health and wellness over any college or university admission letter. And we're focused on raising the kid we've got and encouraging them to be the best version of themselves they can be. We're going to be having our kids look at a set of colleges, you know, people haven't heard of, where they can find a great education, a great set of fit and belonging. You know, value your kid so much more than you value whatever name brand is splashed across the back of your neighbor's car.
One benefit, Julie, it seems, of over-parenting, if there are any, is that kids today are less rebellious than they once were, right? Like, even, you know, we're listening, they like a band, we're going to listen to that band and take them to a concert, and things that maybe our parents did not do with us. So they're not so eager to move out of our houses and be independent, but I wonder if we can hang on to the fact that they like spending time with us without making them dependent upon us until they're in their 40s.
You know what? I just had a great interview this morning with MTV, which, of course, caters to, you know, adolescents and young adults and their content. And they were asking me the same question, which I thought was great. Yes, the one benefit of overparenting is that our kids like us. And it was really great as a college dean to see so many young adults with such a close, fond, loving relationship with their parents. I mean, who wouldn't want that? That is, of course, a good thing. And I say so in my book. So the question is, how can we love them and have them love us, you know, but allow them still to differentiate themselves from us? You know, when we hover over every experience and we're so excited about that band and we take them to the concert and, you know, we know the latest fashion and we know the latest everything, we're kind of getting in the way. This is where I want to say, I have to say this to myself, believe me, and I say it to my fellow parents, like, it's not about us. It's their adolescence. Let them have, you know, their equivalent of the Rolling Stones, which, you know, when teenagers were listening to the Rolling Stones the first time around, the parents weren't. You know, they deserve to have their own, you know, distance from us. You know, when I was in college, and you were in college, you know, we went on road trips to see an indie band or to go to a beach at spring break or just to get lost in the middle of nowhere. And we weren't in contact with parents and nobody feared for our safety, you know, and we had the freedom to tell them about it or not, you know, not to have them alongside for every moment of the experience, experiencing it with us. You know, at Stanford, I saw parents trying to experience some of the rituals that fold a student into the university community. I wanted to say, like, folks, I get that you want to be so close, but it's not about you. West Point, as I write in the book, West Point is seeing the same thing. Mm. So, you know, we've got to be the big folks and say, as much fun as it is to be alongside young adults, you know, becoming their adult selves, or, you know, adolescents experiencing all their wacky adolescent stuff, it's not about us. They need some privacy. They need some freedom. They need some distance.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Allison on the line in Arlington. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
So my comment is that I think some of the parents who overparent are parents who have fewer children. We have 5 children, and not to say that we never overparent, because I'm sure there are times that we do, but there are so many of them that it's not always, we're not always available to sit around and scoop them up and, you know, pander to their every needs. And I think that affects how people look at their children and what they do by the quantity of children that they have.
That's an interesting perspective.
Allison, I agree with you completely. And thanks for calling and for saying so. You know, yes, being able to overparent is a function of having time on your hands and often money on your hands. This is a problem, you know, in communities that are solidly middle class to upper middle class to beyond. So, yeah, you with your five kids, you can't pay attention to where everyone is at every moment, what everyone's doing and hovering and intervening. And your kids are better off for it. I feel happy for you and for your kids. The other contributor to this sense of preciousness and we need to be there at all times, I think, is the reality for many of us is we've had some fertility issues. And when you've worked so hard to just conceive your child, you know, it's hard then to back off and not want to attend to every moment of their existence once they're born.
Talk about this, because so many public schools today and private schools as well really rely on parent volunteers. They can't do it all because budgets are tight. And it's great to have parents involved in the schools. We know this is good for kids. And yet, having mom or dad sort of around for several hours of every day during every school week, again, kind of takes away that ability to feel fully separated.
Yeah, it's another great example of, you know, that we have to perceive that there is a line and stay on the right side of it. Absolutely, schools benefit from parental involvement. And let's face it, we could be on a different radio show. We could be talking about a different topic, which is parental underinvolvement in the life of kids. And that's another problem. It's not the one I've written about. So, yeah, great that parents want to be involved in school. Great for schools, great for kids. But as this woman named Marina, who I quoted, who lives in Santa Clarita, California, told me, she likes to think of school as her kids' place, where she shows up not very frequently and allows them to delight in saying, "Mom, look what I've done. This is my classroom. This is my teacher. Look at my project." She's a mom who tends to show up. She's a stay-at-home mom, you know, has the time, could be more involved in the school, knows plenty of other parents are. She backs off. She volunteers as needed when an extra hand is needed. But she's not one of these parents that sort of hovers and is always there. And her kids delight then in being able to share their school and their experience with her at appropriate moments like back to school night.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Cynthia in Fort Worth. Hi, Cynthia.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Love your show. And I'm so grateful for this topic. I was a single parent. I had my child when I was 21. I'm 45 now. She's 23. And for such a long time, I felt so guilty because I couldn't do what a lot of my counterpart parents were doing. A lot of the parents in my daughter's classes were older and they had money. And I was always struggling and I always felt so behind because I couldn't be the room parent and I couldn't go to every activity. And, you know, there were days where I'd pick her up from school and I was just exhausted and I couldn't look at homework. And then later on, when I went to law school, I felt more of a failure, even though I was trying to make this better life for us. There was just so much I couldn't do. And I always felt that I somehow was letting her down because she had to do so much on her own. And she went to university and she decided, you know, she didn't want to stay in university, but I felt better because these were decisions she was making that were best for her. And when we talked about it and discussed her reason for wanting to leave school for a while, I felt like she had made that decision because we were able to look at what she needed. And now, you know, she's still figuring things out because she's 23. But she's living on her own and she's got a roommate and they pay all their bills and they're desperately poor, but fine. And she's happy. And so now I feel like maybe I didn't fail quite so much after all.
Doesn't sound like you failed at all.
Oh, Cynthia, my goodness. I'm like scribbling notes as you talk. I'm so glad you called. I'm so happy for you. And I'm happy for your daughter, too. You've said so many things that are wise that I just want to I'll try to hit on a few of them. You know, what you're talking about is the fact that kids who often have a little bit harder of a circumstance, one parent instead of two, a younger parent who, you know, instead of an older parent, you know, harder circumstances, emerge from life having had to do more for themselves. They end up knowing themselves better. They know how to make choices. They know how to pick themselves up. When they've had a setback, they emerge with this precious stuff we now call grit and resilience. You know, their affluent parents didn't give it to them. Life gave it to them. And this is a classic example of how more affluent kids with parents who maybe had, you know, higher incomes, you know, better jobs, whatever, may end up being underserved by their parents' affluence. It's this great irony. So more power to you and to your daughter. She's poor but happy, and she's paying her bills. My sense is she's going to figure out what she wants to do with her life, and you're going to be proud of her, and she's going to be just fine.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Susan in Richardson. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you for taking this call. I was thinking, as a former teacher, that the things that we're over-parenting today that I see among the people around me, especially neighbors and things, are protecting them, quote, protecting them from the barriers of rules, protecting them from learning respect. I'll give you an example. They seem to, like, we have things in our neighborhood that go on. There's trash all over left by the young families, or I assume their children. They don't obey the rules of riding bikes on the sidewalk. I mean, does no one teach these kids that it's better to hear no's and let them learn that from their families so that they won't be able to, or so they will be able to deal with them later on?
What do you think about that, Julie?
Yeah, absolutely. Susan, thanks for the call. And you're describing a very common type of parenting these days, which according to those who study these things in psychology and sociology, they call it permissive slash indulgent type of parenting. These are parents who don't lay down any rules, don't have high expectations for their kids' good character, good habits, good behavior. You know, they're always interested in pleasing their kid, you know, but really aren't setting or enforcing any rules and guidelines. So that's certainly, you know, a type of overparenting, doing everything for your kid and just sort of never setting rules. The opposite type, if you will, are the type that have very high expectations and aren't very nice toward their kids. These are the authoritarian types, or the tiger parent, if you will, who has super harsh expectations for what their kid must do, you know, not only at home, but in school, you know, choosing their path for them, and really doesn't care at all what their kid thinks. The sweet spot between these two improper types, between permissive slash indulgent and authoritarian, is authoritative, which is lots of rules, lots of expectations, consequences if you don't meet expectations, but also you're responsive to your kids' needs as well. You're kind, you have conversations with them, and so on. That's apparently what we're all supposed to be aiming for, authoritative parenting.
Julie Lithcott-Hames is my guest, Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford. Her new book is called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Julie Lithcott-Hames is my guest. She joins us from the studios at Stanford University to talk about her new book, How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Julie, you are a big believer in not becoming the personal chauffeur for your children, but even you have come up against resistance from other parents who are shocked that you would let your kids, say, walk a mile to school or to the store or to a friend's house. How do you handle it, and how do you teach kids to handle it when other parents are appalled?
Well, let me clarify. It wasn't a mile. It was about 0.3 miles that my kids' friends' parents didn't want them to walk or bike alone. You know, in the back of my book is in four parts, and the fourth part is kind of dare to be the parent you want to be. Reclaim yourself is one chapter, and be the parent you want to be is the final chapter. And in that final chapter, I offer what I call simple scripts for difficult moments, I think it is, or complicated moments. It's when other parents are saying, wait a minute, you know, how could you let her bike to school alone? You know, how do you handle that without judging the other parent, but with in a way that confidently states the philosophy those of us who don't want to overparent have? And this is the philosophy. It's our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job and raise our kids to be independent. And so childhood is meant to prevent, to offer opportunities every step of the way. So I'm not neglecting her by letting her walk. I need her to walk. She needs to learn to walk or bike or buy things in a store on her own and so on. You know, I think it's a mixture of, you know, that wise philosophy, but then humility and humor. You know, I think sometimes just shrugging your shoulders and saying, look, I don't want to be that parent who's still doing everything for their kids when they're 18. You know, I think that that actually goes a long way when parents can envision that future day that none of us wants, which is a helpless 20-year-old. You know, there's an example I give. I actually don't give it in the book, but it's a great example of how our seemingly helpful efforts lead to bad outcomes, a benign outcome, but still an outcome you don't want. I know of a Stanford student whose parents always filled her car with gas in high school, and she lives her home is California. She came to college at Stanford in California. And whenever her parents came to visit, which was fairly frequently, they'd fill up her car still with gas on the Stanford campus. So then it's summertime. Say she's 20. Her boyfriend is visiting home. They go out for a drive. They discover the car is low on gas. They say, oh my gosh, the car is low on gas. Have you ever pumped gas? No, neither have I. Okay, let's try it. They're smart after all. They can figure this out. You know, they go to the gas station, figure it out, put gas in the car. Moments later, as they're driving away, the engine starts knocking. And they look at each other and say, oh my gosh, we put diesel in the car. Oh my gosh, that's why the nozzle didn't fit. Oh my gosh, oh my gosh. You know, here they are, sort of helpless, bewildered, hapless, like they're embarrassed. You know, you don't want to pump your kids gas forever such that they become young 20-somethings who've never pumped gas, okay? You know, just think ahead. You need to inculcate the skill, not to pretend you're always going to be there to pump their gas.
Julie Lithcott-Hames is here. She's former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford. I love, by the way, social media. You and I are talking here on the phone. You tweeted me and said, by the way, I stepped down 3 years ago, so you might want to clarify. I love that we can have this like two-level conversation, but I appreciate the correction, so thank you for that.
Absolutely.
Let's jump back on the phones here. We have David on the line in Dallas. Hello, David.
Hi. I have a question that's very relevant to what y'all were just talking about. I have two young girls. And, you know, not just the parents judging you, but you have parents now that will actually call the police if you let them play in the park by themselves or go on a bike ride unattended. You know, how do you square wanting your child to grow up and know themselves with parents who are so overzealous will actually call the police or the school district and get social services involved?
David, that story is ripped from today's headlines. I know it. I know we all are fearful in light of what we hear happening, say, for example, to the Matev family in Maryland, whose 10 and 6-year-old were subject to that kind of scrutiny from a seemingly well-meaning stranger and ended up, you know, in a police car. Boy, is this an encroachment. I think this may be the one issue on which liberals and conservatives can agree in our country today. This is an encroachment of the state, of the government, in the form of police and child protective services into the life of parents, criminalizing parental behavior for harm that might have come to a kid if this and that or the other had happened. It didn't happen. Somebody just called the police and, you know, for a child who appeared to be alone. So here's what you do. First of all, it all comes down to your kid, your street, your park, and your community. I can't here in Palo Alto give a blanket answer that's going to apply to you in Dallas or to anyone else per se. Know your community. Band together with other parents to decide what feels like normal and good for your community with the goal of giving our kids more freedom and independence in mind. You know, follow your kid to the park, fine, if that needs to happen, but let them walk, you know, and skip and, you know, jump, you know, 20 steps ahead of you. You know, be at the park, but don't be right there hovering. You know, let them have their free play. You're there to provide your watchful eye if that's the community moray. But always know your job is to increase that distance over the years so that they develop the confidence that they can be out in the world world without you. And I think also we've got to band together with our community leaders, you know, our school board leaders, our city council folks, our police, and say, hey, can we decide what's okay in our community? Let's not have the police be blindsided by trumped up stats of stranger danger. You know, when a school says a third grader can walk home alone, which is the case in my community, but the police see a third grader walking alone and escort him to his parents' door, that's, you know, our government left hand and right hand, you know, not being in sync. So there's a lot that needs to happen, but it begins with you, David, and me.
Question here via email. We've had a number of questions about homeschooling, and this one from Leslie says, do you think the huge growth in homeschooling is a result or a symptom of overparenting?
Wow, what a good question, Leslie. I don't know the answer. I have some hunches. I think many parents are exasperated by what they see happening in schools and think, I can do better myself. Great, more power to you if you have the time and knowledge and, you know, inclination. But if you're homeschooling, you've got to figure out how to socialize your kid. You know, we don't want homeschooled kids who don't know how to work out disputes with other kids, who don't know how to, you know, talk to a teacher when the teacher isn't mom or dad. You know, we've got to prepare them for the real world that is far less loving, you know, and far less interested in meeting their every need than often is the case at home. So I think if you're homeschooling, really, regardless of whether you're doing it because of the overparenting problem or, you know, you're creating the problem, you know, we've in the homeschooling environment, you've got to focus on, you know, raising an independent, self-actualized kid.
Interesting question via email from Caitlin, who says, how would you suggest parents protect children who are members of oppressed minorities, gay, transgender, Muslim, African-American, etc., without compromising their ability to deal with prejudice as adults?
Well, Caitlin, I'm an African-American mom with a black son, and I think about this every day, of course. You know, I think with any kid, whether they're a member of an oppressed minority, as you put it, or they have special needs, or they're, you know, a typically developing straight white kid, we've got to teach our kids to advocate for themselves. We have to love them, embrace them for who they are, support them in being the best version of their self they can be, you know, teach them skills, teach them habits, cultivate a good character. You know, a kid who has a sense of self and can be respectful and loving toward other humans out in the world is going to find the world, you know, greets and treats them more favorably than if they behave otherwise. And I think, you know, whether, you know, it's how to talk to police, you know, how to behave in stores, you know, I think, you know, we want to teach them that the world often makes assumptions when they see a certain skin color or last name. And, you know, we don't want our kid to wither under, you know, the stereotype others might have of them. We want them to be aware of that stereotype and, you know, behave in a way that doesn't, you know, allow people to, you know, label them in that way.
Okay, Julie, I'm going to assume that you have evangelized successfully today, and maybe you've made some converts, people who don't want to overparent. They think they might be overdoing it. Given, though, that, you know, let's assume a lot of folks have children who have become accustomed to a certain level of service from mom and dad, they might object to something changing. How do you begin to turn the Titanic around?
What a great question, Chris. And thank you for saying I might have successfully evangelized. I hope I have. Here are a couple of things. Number one, what you can stop doing right now after you finish listening to this, you know, to Chris's wonderful program. Three things. Stop saying we when you mean your son or daughter. We're not on the soccer team. We're not doing the science project. We're not applying to college. If you say, you know, my son, my daughter, you're actually giving them their due recognition for the work they're doing and the achievements they're having. That's one. Don't say we. Number two, stop arguing with all of the adults in their lives. You know, teachers, coaches, principals, referees, for the most part, are adult figures who deserve the respect and authority, one of your earlier callers mentioned. And, you know, we need to teach our kids to respect these folks. And when those folks, you know, need to be talked to, when we have something we need to say, we got to empower our kid to have respectful conversations advocating for their own needs, not to pretend we'll always be there to do it for them. And the third thing is stop doing your kids' homework. We are doing too much of the essay writing. We're correcting the math problems. And when we do that in fourth grade, we'll do it in eighth grade. And we do it in eighth grade, we'll do it for college admission. And we might do it in college and the workplace. I kid you not, this happens. So stop saying we, stop arguing with the adults, stop doing their homework. Now, when it comes to actually teaching the skills they need, whether it's how to cross the street, how to make a meal, how to do your own work. First, we do it for them. Then we do it with them. Then we watch them do it. Then they do it alone. That's the four-step process I learned from folks actually in the special needs community about how to teach life skills to kids. Whether your kid is typically developing or has special needs, those four stages will help you teach them what they need to know in order to get out in the world and be independent adults one day.
So I have a Facebook friend who posted this morning about packing her daughter's bags for vacation, and these are teenagers. I think the idea is that she just doesn't want to have them forget anything. It seems to me like by doing it for them, she's telling them you cannot possibly handle putting a week's worth of clothes in a canvas bag.
Chris, you're absolutely right. I know by now that you could have written this book for me. I'm just delighted to be on your show. Okay, so yeah, we're actually sending this really insidious message that bores into their developing minds. And the message is this: hey, kid, you're incapable. I need to do this for you. Boy, is that damaging. And yeah, that contributes to the rates of depression and anxiety we see in adolescents and young adults. Here's the point. Whether it's they've forgotten homework, you know, they left their homework behind as they raced out the door, or they left their lunch behind, you know, or they're packing for a trip. If they don't do it for themselves and experience that very, very short-term harm or hurt of the forgotten homework, the missed lunch, or the bag packed wrong, quote unquote, if they don't learn it, they will forever be making those mistakes. And you are forever consigning yourself to the role of doing it for them. That's not what you want. It's a parenting fail if your kid can't pack their own bag, you know, by the time they've gone to college. And, you know, dare I say, you know, even in the teenage years when they're going to sleepaway camp or boarding school. I mean, these services, you can pay someone $1,000 to pack your kids' bags for boarding school. I mean, come on. We're raising veal. There's this educator, Joe Maruzczak. I took this term from him. He's a great man in Massachusetts. He said, young adults are like veal running home in the face of the world's slaughter. And I agree with him. We don't want to raise veal. We want to raise warriors, strong kids who are going to assume the mantle of leadership from Gen X and lead our great nation and maybe look after us one day, you know, and maybe raise their own kids. I mean, how the heck are they going to do that if they're relying on us to do everything for them still?
How much of this problem comes down to unintentional parental narcissism, the sense that we are the center of our children's worlds and should remain so?
Oh, my goodness. Well, yeah. Boy, we have so much wrapped up in our kids' accomplishments. It's like, look at my masterpiece, my child. Okay? I heard Wendy Mogul and Denise Pope at a Challenge Success Conference last fall or the fall before put it that way so beautifully. You know, our child is not our masterpiece. Your child should not be your hobby or your greatest accomplishment. Many of us, too many of us, think this. And you know what? Carl Jung said something to the effect of the greatest harm to a child is the unlived life of the parent. They don't need us to put all of that, you know, ego baggage on them. They're going to have their own issues. Let's not have them contend with ours. Let them be their own person. We gave them life, Chris, but life is to be lived. You know, kids today are experiencing higher rates of anxiety and depression because we've deprived them of the chance to construct a self. A self. Self-efficacy comes from seeing how one's actions and behaviors lead to results. When we've done so much for them, we've actually, in a psychological sense, deprived them of a chance to be. And when I say be, I mean italics be. The word be, exist, okay? This is what our overhelping does. It's tremendously harmful. We need to stop.
Julie Lithcott-Hames is former Dean of Freshman and Undergraduate Advising at Stanford. Her new book is called How to Raise an Adult, Break Free of the Overparenting Trap and Prepare Your Kid for Success. Julie, it's been a delight to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Chris, thank you. I'm on howtoraiseanadult.com. You can find me there on Facebook. My Twitter is @raiseanadult. Please join the social conversation. Join the community of parents pushing the pendulum, parenting pendulum back in the other direction toward raising adults.
Thanks. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.